Welcome to the Victory Kitchen. For this episode, which is episode 31, we are going to be talking about a vague and completely unexplored aspect of American wartime food rationing. And that would be hospital farms. Food rationing at hospitals makes sense, but if you're anything like me, you might be doing a double take thinking, wait a minute, hospitals had farms? That's exactly what we'll be exploring. What hospital farms were, how they served hospitals, and how World War II impacted them. So let's dig in. Welcome to the Victory Kitchen, the podcast all about American food rationing during World War II. I'm your host, Sarah Creviston Lee, author, historian, and vintage foodie. I'll be exploring the logistics of food rationing, featuring wartime cookbooks and recipes, and highlighting real homefront experiences. We're going to be learning exactly what our grandmothers had to do to get their food to fight for victory. I wanted to really quickly let you know that I have migrated my podcast blog from Blogger over to Substack. And this is for a few reasons, but I mainly wanted to be able to have the ability to communicate more directly with people who follow my podcast. This way, when you subscribe to my Substack, you're able to be notified directly to your email that I've posted a new post. And so whenever I have a new podcast episode come up, I pretty quickly, at least I try to get my blog posts up as well. And then I also have been trying to post other things on my Substack that are just for my Substack readers that have to do with wartime and food that don't necessarily fit in exactly with my podcast, but still are relevant. You can subscribe to my podcast Substack at victorykitchenpodcast.substack.com. And now on to the episode. So I was at my doctor's appointment the other day, and my doctor very kindly asked how my podcast was going. And I mentioned that my next episode was about hospital farms. And she had never heard about hospitals having farms at all. And this is nothing against my wonderful doctor, but it surprised me a little bit because I was just surprised that doctors wouldn't know the history of hospitals in America. That's just me being a history nerd, but it also speaks to this particular topic, how difficult it was to research. It just, not a lot of people know about this. It's really not surprising that she didn't know about it because I had never heard of it, and anyone I talked to has also never heard about it. It was quite the journey researching this episode, but I'm very excited to share with you what I did learn. And it is really an interesting and very important aspect of agricultural history, as you will find out. So I want to go back in time a little bit and discuss a brief history of the relationship of food and hospitals in America. And a little bit before that. So there's actually a long history of and connection of hospitals and at least gardens dating back as far as the Middle Ages in Europe, linking medical recovery and being in nature. But I'm sure there are other cultures around the world through time that also discovered this that I'm just unaware of. And this part doesn't necessarily connect to food exactly, but it does come into play later in our discussion. So the biggest connection that I found in American history comes from the Civil War. And this is having to do with the U.S. Sanitary Commission. The U.S. Sanitary Commission was a civilian-run organization. They noticed the appalling conditions the Union soldiers were living with and wanted to do something to help. So it was formed in April 1861 and continued its work until 1866, and it was run by very enterprising women. At the beginning, it was more of a preventative care organization, but once the Civil War was in full swing, they realized they needed to shift their efforts to more emergency relief response. They had the federal government's blessing and President Lincoln's blessing to run, but not the funding. So all the funding was done through private channels and donations from people in the North. So two aspects of their work that stood out to me in the context of our conversation today is their diet kitchens and that they had hospital gardens. So with the diet kitchens, I actually turned to my two friends, Kirsten and Brianne Lamb. They are two sisters who do Civil War reenacting, but they do a lot of research, and especially about the U.S. Sanitary Commission. So to quote my friend Brianne, she says that a diet kitchen was specifically set up to prepare special meals for men recovering from varying degrees of wounds and sickness. It was not your typical mess or dining hall. The meals were prescribed to meet each patient's individual needs by hospital staff. As they made their daily rounds through the wards, surgeons filled out specific schedules for breakfast, dinner, which was lunch, and supper. There was a low diet, which included liquids and soft foods. The high diet included more solid foods. Diet kitchens were found in all hospitals, from the field hospitals to the general army hospitals. At some of the more permanent army hospitals, like in General Hospital No. 1 in Frederick, Maryland, hey, that's where I live, they did have their own vegetable gardens to help supplement the foods that were brought in. She does add a note that they had regular dining halls as well to accommodate the staff and patients that were able to move around. The hospital she mentions in Frederick could accommodate 500 men, so pretty substantial. So what's special about this is the development of specialized diets for individual patients. From my understanding, such thinking was new for the time and revolutionized the feeding of hospitalized patients. You know, there had been invalid cooking for a long time, but this way of feeding almost like prescribed diets for specific individual patients was different and new. The second aspect I wanted to talk about is their hospital gardens or their hospital farms. And as part of their work during the Civil War in keeping Union soldiers in the South healthy when transportation of fresh food was difficult, their solutions were these hospital farms. And so this was when the Union soldiers were occupying parts of the South that they had captured. So they had established themselves enough so that they had hospitals for the patients. To quote an article that I found on the New York Public Library blog written by Susan Wade, she says, in 1863, thanks to the help from the U.S. Army and its medical staff, the U.S. Sanitary Commission obtained land near Union Army hospitals in Tennessee to set up vegetable gardens serving hospital patients and troops. Seeds, gardening tools, and plants were purchased and shipped. Animal manure, generally not a problem. Convalescent soldiers, laborers, and prisoners of war planted, sowed, and reaped under the supervision of a head gardener. The idea took hold quickly. When it came to a hospital garden in New Bern, North Carolina, there was a record talking about that had lists of produce with yields by date, and it said that the plantings and harvests were abundant and mouthwatering, including peas, squash, melons, beans, potatoes, radishes, onions, cucumbers, corn, okra, carrots, cabbages, and more. And what's interesting, too, is that the list of recipients is a quick introduction to the world of need met by the U.S. Sanitary Commission, including two general hospitals, numerous regiments and U.S. Navy steamers, several outlying posts, attached services such as the Signal Corps and Ambulance Corps and the Brigade Band. The needs of civilians, particularly African-American refugees, were also met. The hospital for refugees, the orphan asylum, and school teachers can be found on the list. So the Sanitary Commission, with their hospital gardens, were feeding not just the invalids at the hospitals, but, you know, other parts of the army and refugees and the orphan asylum, school teachers. I mean, they were feeding the communities around them. Very fascinating. So What does this have to do with World War II? Well, this sanitary commission really laid kind of a foundation, and, you know, having these ideas how to function in war and how to feed soldiers, how to keep them healthy in this time of war. You know, ideas like these stick around. And the fact that the gardens were connected to the hospitals is also interesting. Now, hospitals, obviously, once we go to World War II, hospitals didn't start having farms just because of World War II. So, you know, they had been in existence before that. But the earliest that I could find records for were these Civil War farms. So that's another connection that I felt was really important to point out. So I'm not really, it's like I said, this was a really difficult topic to research. And I don't know how long hospitals and farms or hospitals and vegetable gardens, like how long they have been connected in America. But I can say at least for as long as the Civil War, since the Civil War in the 1860s. So why did hospitals have farms? Well, you know, we kind of highlighted some of those in, you know, talking about the U.S. Sanitary Commission, but there are more reasons. One reason was so that it was a way for hospitals to be self-sufficient and to reduce the cost of food. It was a way that they could feed their patients and their employees. Many patients had special diets, which they were able to address with their farm and with the fresh foods that came from that farm. In conjunction with that, they could control the quality of food coming into the hospital and reduce the possibility of foodborne illness at its source because there were less middlemen. I did find an article talking about this with their milk. Like, they actually found a problem with their own milk, and so they installed new pasteurization machines so that they wouldn't have that problem anymore. So they were able to take care of that problem themselves and make to ensure that their milk was clean. Gardens and farms had also been a way to offer therapy and recuperation for patients, like I said, from the Middle Ages. It had long been known that being outside in nature, working with soil and plants, held many benefits for mental health. And I came across many accounts of patients working the farms themselves. It wasn't just hired help, but I was actually astonished by how many farms had able-bodied patients. They weren't just like getting everyone out of their bed and saying, okay, time for farm work. I mean, it was the patients that were able to go and work on the farms. A quick note, farms accompanied many state-run institutions besides hospitals, including poor farms and prisons, where the inmates would do much of the work themselves. So while doing research on hospital farms, I came across just as much information about prison farms as I did hospital farms, which was still not much information. But I really wanted to point that out. That's really important information because they kind of, for some reason there, because the state hospitals were, you know, state-run institution, the prisons were state-run institutions, a lot of times they were linked in these newspaper articles or even in census records. Okay, so now we're going to turn to these hospital farms and the laborers who worked on these farms. This was the first time I had actually used a census record in my research for a podcast episode. It was quite exciting because, I mean, I've worked with census records before for genealogy, but never used it for a podcast episode. So this was fun. So I found several 1940 census enumeration records that looked at different hospitals. So Binghamton State Hospital in New York and St. Lawrence State Hospital. These both had farms. So these were the occupations that I found. And there were some other hospitals kind of thrown in here too. I just found what I could. There are mental hospitals, a state hospital, an insane hospital. There's like a variety of different types of hospitals that I was pulling information from. So the occupations were a dairyman, poultryman, cook, farm manager, a teamster, so somebody that would drive the horses for plowing, a trucker, a cook, waitress, chef, meat cutter, and a dietitian. So these were the occupations in the census records that specifically worked at these hospitals that had to do with food. I was really focusing on the food and the farm aspects. There were other people that worked on these farms as well. Actually, this is what sparked this episode idea. And it was this article I came across when I was doing research for my conscientious objector episode. And I just gave it away. It was conscientious objectors. Now, I can't 100% say that they worked on hospital farms, because in what I know about conscientious objectors, they usually worked in the hospitals themselves as like orderlies or in mental hospitals doing other things. But I haven't come across articles saying that they worked on the farms themselves. But in this particular article, they are proposing the idea. It's from the Richmond Times in Virginia from May 1942. It says, "War objectors asked as aides on farms. Lack of orderlies, attendants, and farm workers in the state's far-flung system of mental institutions has created an acute and serious problem," Mr. Questenbury points out. "Large numbers of the hospital's personnel are being taken for military service by selective service. Many are volunteering, and still others are being lost to war production industries. In all the 6 state hospitals, this loss of manpower is being keenly felt. But at Williamsburg, which is near the shipyards at Newport News and Norfolk, the decimation of the ranks of hospital employees has approached a crucial stage," Mr. Questenbury said. "At the Eastern Institution, for instance, 1 4-story building is being operated by a graduate nurse, a woman, and a 20-year-old youth who has been with the hospital staff just 4 months. There are only 20 attendants caring for 850 men at Williamsburg, whereas the minimum should be 50. Mr. Questenbury's plans calls for employment of duly classified conscientious objectors on the farms operated in conjunction with the hospital at Staunton Marion, Lynchburg, Williamsburg, and the 2 at Petersburg. By such employment, the food supply is assured, and numbers of farm attendants might then be transferred into the hospitals themselves as orderlies or attendants. The farms are in desperate straits," Mr. Questenbury said, "and the hospital system must produce food in order to maintain itself under present appropriations. Even operating all 6 farms at their capacity, there is insufficient food supplied to meet all the demands of the hospitals, but this production is indeed a major factor. Something must be done, and this appears to be a reasonable solution of the difficulties." Like I said, I don't know if this particular request was approved, but it's likely, considering how other COs worked on farms and other, you know, and like I said, they worked in other medical institutions. So it seemed like a very good suggestion that they could free up the farm laborers that were already there so that those guys could go and work as orderlies and attendants in the hospitals. Other laborers that worked in hospital farms were Victory Farm volunteer laborers. I found another article from the Richmond Times-Dispatch from Virginia in 1945. That talks about boys who would go and work on these farms. It says, "Here in Richmond, Pine Camp Hospital Farm gets some needed boy power from Victory Farm volunteers. G.T. Shutt, who manages the 75 acres of truck crops, says he couldn't get along without 6 boys who pull weeds and pick vegetables. The group includes 2 sets of twins, Turner and Thomas Nelms and Claude and Lewis Jones. It also includes Richard Harris and Marion Mason. Shutt has used boys for 3 years and thinks he just couldn't have gotten all the work done if he hadn't had their help. The vegetables he produces go to the Pine Camp Hospital and also to the Municipal Hospital and Sheltering Arms." The fact that these boys were coming in and helping with these crops so that they could get to the hospitals is definitely noteworthy. And finally, we already talked about the patients themselves who would sometimes be called upon to work on the farms if they were capable. And, you know, this, like I mentioned before, had also its own health benefits. You know, working in the soil can be very therapeutic. So if it's, depending on what their ailment was, if it was more mental health, you know, it could definitely benefit them. If it was a physical ailment, then, you know, I'm not sure how they would determine if a patient could help on the farm. So, and it also depended on the patient's skills. Maybe they were a farmer themselves. So I'm sure it was case by case basis, but I find that really cool that they were also able to help. Now we are going to talk about the food itself and what they grew on farms and what they did with it. So, you know, World War II, we've got rationing. Hospitals definitely were not left untouched. Securing good, inexpensive food for hospital patients and staff was hard work. Their farms worked hard to meet this need. So, you know, when wartime rationing hit America, hospitals had to deal with the same problems as everyone else. I found one article specifically speaking to this point. It's from the Mercury from Pennsylvania, dated March 1943. It says, "Food rationing hits hospitals. Food rationing is hitting meals for the sick harder than meals for the healthy, according to officials of local hospitals. Leon Hook," I think that's how you say his name, "superintendent of Pottstown Hospital, said yesterday that the hospital had received its meat points and also those for processed foods, and they are very meager. Those for processed foods are good for about 1/6 of the amount usually used by the institution," he said, "and we are told to buy fresh foods. The question is, where can they be secured in sufficient quantities? In a hospital with 50 cases, there are 30 special diets required on average," the superintendent continued, "and the way it looks, we are going to be very short and need extra amounts. Of course, we will make application for the additional points." At the homeopathic hospital, Miss Mabel Green, superintendent, was a little more optimistic. Miss Green said that the points for the institution have been cut considerably, but she thinks that points for extra food for special diets will be granted by the ration board. "Doctors will be required to sign applications for the points," she explained. The official stressed the fact that fresh vegetables will help out, and although she admits that the situation is rather bad, she thinks that the kitchen will be able to get along. So I find this great information. And I like that they point out that the question is, like, where can these sufficient quantities of fresh foods be obtained? I think that's a very important thing to point out, because I want to make a note here. Not all hospitals had farms. you might have been wondering that. But yeah, not all hospitals in the 1940s had farms, especially those in more urban settings. I was digging through some New York Times articles, and yeah, none of those guys had farms. So when rationing hit for them, it was definitely a hardship. So what I found is that there were three different types of hospitals and how they fed patients. One is like these New York City hospitals in urban settings that bought all their food on the open market because they didn't have a farm. Then the second category were hospitals that did have farms, but maybe they were smaller farms, so they were able to supplement their food, but then they also still had to buy food on the open market and just kind of fill in the gaps. Then there were the hospitals with larger farms, to the point where they usually had a surplus and that they were then able to sell that surplus or exchange it with other institutions. So there was this interesting exchange thing going on, which I also found really fascinating. I'm not sure how that exchange worked, if it was like, here you go, and could you give us some of that, or whatever that would be, I don't know. Or if I'm guessing the other institution would buy it from them because it would be an asset. Yeah, very interesting. And then that way it would stay within the hospital system. But I really feel for these hospitals that did not have any sort of farm whatsoever. You know, what were they to do? Because they had to feed their patients and their staff somehow. And they were classified as like a restaurant, like these dining rooms that they had and operated. They had a difficult time. Even though they, yeah, we'll get into it in just a minute. First, I wanted to focus on what kinds of things that they grew. I'm always interested in that. I don't know about you, but I like the nitty-gritty details. So we're going to get into it. So I'm just going to go through this a list of a few hospital farms and what state they reside in and then what they grew, because it's kind of cool to know. So for the Eastern State Hospital farm from Kentucky, they had 324 total acres. They grew Irish potatoes, sweet potatoes, parsnips, turnips, carrots, cabbage, and they canned their extra fruits and vegetables and meats. Then there's the Oregon State Hospital farms. They were very successful. They had 4,085 acres. They had dairy, poultry, hogs, cows, potatoes, cabbage, table carrots, celery, sweet corn, greens, rhubarb, parsnips, green peas, raspberries, squash, tomatoes, cherries, grapes, and prunes. Wow, they must have eaten really well. Then there is the Fort George Wright Convalescent Center Hospital Farm. Now, this was a little bit different of a farm. It was run by the U.S. military. They didn't necessarily raise crops, at least not that I could tell from the article that I read, but they raised animals. And this was specifically for the convalescence of the wounded soldiers that came to stay there. And so they raised, this was in Washington state, they raised chickens, pigeons, who were raised by the Army Signal Corpsmen, makes sense, hogs, steer, sheep, rabbits, goats, guinea fowl, and horses. The focus was on the animals and convalescence through taking care of the animals and giving the men something to do as they healed. They just felt like instead of sitting around doing nothing and thinking about how wounded they are, if they had a purpose, then their healing would progress much faster. And that was definitely the case. So this is a really special hospital farm. And I really wanted to highlight that. Next, we have the U.S. General Hospital Farm in Colorado. They had 50 acres plus 75 acres to hay. They grew sweet corn, green beans, beets, carrots, lettuce, peas, tomatoes, and turnips. This hospital was special because they quick froze their extra vegetables and kept them in the hospital's cold storage lockers. So that's pretty cool. Then there's the Eastern State Hospital farm in Virginia. They had 660 acres and then a vegetable garden that was 220 acres. They grew corn, tomatoes, snap peas, Irish potatoes, sweet potatoes. The extra vegetables were canned for winter use, but surplus potatoes sold to other institutions. Then 90 acres of land was set aside for pasture to produce milk. They didn't use the milk to make butter, as the milk was used at the table with all of its fat content. They purchased additional powdered milk for use in cooking. And then to fulfill their needs for meat, they butchered 10 hogs a week. And in the article, it says supplies now are sufficient to serve an average of 9 ounces of meat a day to each of the 1,957 persons representing the patients and staff who are fed in the hospital dining rooms. So no chickens were raised on the farm. Therefore, they had to purchase their weekly need of 780 dozen eggs. Whoa. But they did have plans for poultry department. So that was being considered. So this was in May of 1944. Wow, 780 dozen eggs a week. That's insane. Maybe you're all thinking about the price of eggs right now. All right. So that's the list of hospitals. And I hope you found that as interesting as I did. It's just kind of cool to see what they were growing back then to feed their patients and staff. Now, if you were going to stay at a hospital in wartime, what would happen? Would you have to hand over your ration book? That's a very good question. And I found the answer in an article from the Sumter Daily Item from South Carolina in March 1943. The requirement regarding ration books for patients staying 7 days or more was this: the responsibility to give their ration book to the hospital office lay with the patient. The patient, not the hospital, would suffer the penalty for not complying. If they thought they were staying only a few days but found it to be longer, they were still responsible for depositing their ration book with the office on the 7th day. So your limit was a week. If you were staying less than that, you did not have to turn in your ration book. But if you're staying longer, then you did. And so maybe this was why they were classified as like a restaurant, because restaurants didn't take ration coupons. But if you're there, obviously, for a longer period of time, then no longer the restaurant experience, I guess. So I find that really interesting. And the article actually goes into more detail. Hospitals enjoy no exemptions and are grouped with canteens, lunchrooms, hotels, restaurants, civic and social organizations. Furthermore, hospitals, unlike public eating places, cannot control the number of persons to be fed, nor the food to be consumed by such methods as closing down at a certain hour or for any part of a day, but must be prepared to serve to the limit of their bed capacity for 24 hours a day and every day in the year. This is but one of the many hardships which the war has imposed upon your hospital. Others are shortage of doctors, nurses, and servants. Your hospital expects to cooperate with the government to the fullest extent, considering the purpose of the rationing plan. But such cooperation is only possible in the same measure as a patriotic public complies with this requirement. I think they're pleading like, please, please cooperate. So it then goes on to list other requests for the quote-unquote considerate public to comply with at the hospital. There are two items that I thought was worth reading. The first one is, don't kick if the crockery on your breakfast tray doesn't all match. Hospitals are short on china. Training camps have first call. Oh, dear. I don't know if I'd be upset by that, but I guess some people might be. Number two is, don't ask for food not on the menu. Many food items are scarce, and kitchen help for the hospital is as hard to get as household help for the home. So yeah, don't make the kitchen staff mad, because they're all we've got. That's pretty much what they're saying. So I will have the full list that they ask the considerate public to comply with on my Substack post. Anyway, keep an eye out for that. Something that I didn't want to leave out is food storage. Food for hospitals with farms wasn't just seasonal. They preserved as much of their food as possible for the winter months as well. Many hospitals can their surplus food. I found an article from Virginia where the state hospital had an arrangement with the Extension Service where it seemed that the hospital got to use some of their land for experimental purposes in growing vegetables. And then in exchange, the Extension Service would can the surplus vegetables for the hospital and return it to them for winter use. So that's interesting. Then I found several articles talking about hospitals having or constructing cold storage rooms. This was to enable them to store various foods for longer periods in a larger refrigeration room instead of just like a refrigerator type situation, to store certain types of vegetables in their natural state without having to can them. And as one hospital superintendent stated, This will help the war effort because we won't have to buy so many tin cans hereafter. So, you know, without needing to can them, because then we can store them in like a chilled room, you know, that saves time, it saves energy, and it saves tin, because, you know, I guess they would either can them, like can them, or bottle them, you know. They also utilized frozen food. And I mentioned this a little earlier. It was the U.S. General Hospital in Denver, Colorado, that made use of this technology. And it says, although huge quantities are used daily in the hospital, there is a surplus that is quick frozen in cardboard containers and placed in the hospital's cold storage lockers. There is no waste. I love this. I really love that these hospitals are getting creative to store and like preserve and store their food for their needs so that they don't have to buy as much on the open market if that option was available to them. And then finally, I just wanted to mention about like preparing food for patients. I didn't find any articles or anything necessarily about this, but I did come across several photographs. I found images of staff and youth volunteers. Well, staff meaning like kitchen help and youth volunteers preparing food for patients and delivering it to their rooms. In one picture, it shows a campfire girl working as a hospital aide. This is from a McCall's magazine. This little girl in braids is sitting in a hospital bed and the campfire girl is feeding her red Jell-O. I don't know how many of you have been served Jell-O during a hospital stay. I know I have. So gelatin as hospital food is still going strong. Thanks, World War II. Okay, so for some final thoughts, I wanted to turn to this article from the Danville Morning News out of Pennsylvania from April 1943. At the Second War Conference of the Hospital Association of Pennsylvania, Representative Maury Maverick, who's the director of the Governmental Division of the War Production Board, called for an urgent resolution in regards to hospitals. He was calling for a commission of Army, Navy, and hospital representatives to study existing hospital facilities to find out what things they needed and how other types of buildings could be converted to hospitals, and to additionally investigate other problems facing hospitals such as food rationing and shortage of materials and equipment. Harold T. Prenzel, business manager of the Friends Hospital in Philadelphia, commented on the resolution saying, "If the battlefields are going to send back 1 million or perhaps 2 million casualties, we in the hospitals must be ready to provide complete hospital care. Government hospital facilities are now inadequate. The resolution correctly implies that military hospitals can be only emergency way stations and that the long pull for rehabilitation of major war casualties will take months and years in the hospitals here at home. But the resolution requires the recognition of hospital service as essential war service. Hospitals must have prior consideration in the rationing of food, fuel, and shelter. They must have manpower to prepare for the rebuilding of minds and bodies broken in the war. One hospital in Pennsylvania has already closed. Others will follow. Unless official Washington is made to realize the importance of voluntary hospitals in wartime and in the post-war period." So these men were looking forward for hospitals, which is where they needed to be looking. You know, when you're at the beginning or even in the thick of war, you're not necessarily thinking about how do we keep this sustainable or what comes next. So this was written in 1943, 2 years before the end of World War II. They didn't know when the end would be, but they were thinking of the millions of casualties, the thousands and thousands of broken men that would be returning home that would need long-term care. And they found the current health care system wanting and in desperate need of being placed in the priority. If hospital food systems were placed with lunch canteens and restaurants, you can see where they were on the list of importance for the government. The hospitals with farms, when they had enough farm help, were able to empower themselves to feed their patients and staff despite the wartime restrictions. Not every hospital had the ability to provide that, but we can see that the hospitals that did have farms are an inspiring example of self-sufficiency and an important aspect of American agricultural history that we need to remember. Today's cookbook feature is Kitchen Strategy: What, Why, How to Feed Your Family by Leona M. Bayer, MD. This was published in 1943. So I sadly do not have a wartime cookbook published by a hospital, but this was published from a doctor. Oh, and Edith S. Green, BA. So, and the foreword is by the chief of pediatrics out of Mount Zion Hospital in San Francisco. So this was the closest I could get. Let me read you the foreword written by Ernst Wolf, MD, the chief of pediatrics. It says, just as the American mother and housewife was becoming acutely aware of the importance of good diet, the impact of the war made her problem at the same time immeasurably more difficult and more urgent to solve. Everyone realizes the special role of diet in maintaining health and efficiency under wartime pressures, but now that the need is most pressing, rationing and shortages so complicate the picture that only an easygoing understanding of essentials can assure the skill necessary to plan adequate meals. One must know not only the recommended daily food items, but also how to substitute for them when they are not available. With the help of the dietetic fundamentals gathered in this book, the housewife should be able to do a superior job of feeding her family despite wartime restrictions. The outline showing the usual dietetic routines for ordinary ailments is a most valuable section in the present emergency. Everywhere in civilian life, there exists a shortage of doctors. The suggestions in this book for handling the dietetic aspects of minor illnesses are safe and generally accepted. As a supplement to medical advice, they can save the physician the time often needlessly spent in giving detailed dietary instructions. I anticipate that the book will bring new food for thought and new thoughts for food to many a family table. And this cookbook most definitely does focus on nutrition. There is a huge section all about the basic food elements, breaking down proteins, carbohydrates, fats, bulk, fluids, calcium, like all the vitamins. And then it goes into menu planning, menus for common ailments. So specific menus to feed someone who has an acute cold or fever, diarrhea and upset stomach, constipation, simple anemia, underweight, overweight. So at just very specific things. Then strategic buying, cooking, serving. And then finally, family cookery. So feeding your family healthy meals. So I put a few recipes to my Patreon to see which ones I should make. And it was a tie. So I made both. The two things that I made were both baked goods. I haven't done baking for a while, so. And I just wasn't really up for, you know, brains or tongue, things like that. And so I went for puffed rice pralines and sponge cake. So let's start with the puffed rice pralines. And these are a type of cookie with the worst directions ever written, or should I say not written. I mean, the ingredients are fine. Well, it says beat and then add, beat and then add and then bake and remove. But it's very, very minimal directions about specifics. I need specifics. So 1 egg, 1 cup of sugar, 1/3 cup melted butter, and you beat these until they're light. Then you add in your 1/4 cup of flour, 1/2 teaspoon salt, 1/4 teaspoon baking powder, 1/2 teaspoon vanilla, and then 2 cups of puffed rice cereal, which I'm always a fan of. That's why I was really drawn to this recipe. I'm like, ooh, a cookie recipe with puffed rice cereal. I'm on board. and they're called pralines. So, yeah. But then it doesn't exactly tell you what to do with it. Like, so this is what the directions say. Bake in moderate oven, 10 to 15 minutes. Remove from pan while still warm. But how did you put it in the pan to begin with? You didn't tell me that part. So originally I was like, okay, I guess it's a sheet pan cookie. I don't know. So that's what I put it in there as, but it wanted to spread everywhere like crazy. And so I had to change it to a bigger pan just because it wasn't baking at all. And I knew something was wrong. I'm like, it's not baking in the time that it's saying. And I set it at 350 because that's kind of a moderate oven. Yeah, it wasn't working in 10 to 15 minutes. So I put it in another pan that was bigger and it spread out way more. It finally did bake and I cut them into bars, but I was like, there's something not right. And I mean, afterwards I'm like, these would have made way better just cookies because cookies can spread out as much as they want. And then I felt like smacking myself in the forehead because I think they're supposed to be cookies. And then I was cursing out the recipe because like, why didn't you just tell me that? I guess the word pralines is the giveaway because I mean, the only time I've had pralines was in the South, in Georgia, and they are individuals like pecan pralines. So yeah, my bad. If you make this recipe, which it was delicious, they have a very yummy taste. They're sweet, they're buttery and crispy. If you make like, at least if you eat the edges, in my case. But if you make them as cookies, they would be wonderful. And with that puffed rice, it's just got the perfect texture. You don't even need nuts, although chopped pecans would be perfect addition to this. So I want to try this recipe again the right way, and then I won't feel so stupid. Oh, well, that's okay. It happens. Oh, my goodness. Now we're going to go to my other failure of a recipe. Is it me? Is it this cookbook? I don't know. It's cursed. It's definitely cursed because I did not have very good success with this recipe either. I can't blame the recipe in this case, though. This was for the sponge cake. And it's a very great recipe. And the reason why I just like zeroed in on this recipe was because it has the basic foundation recipe, and then on the other page, it was a page full of variations that were like wartime friendly. I was just, I don't know, I had stars in my eyes. I was so amazed. I mean, I will have a picture of both of these pages, I mean, of the recipes, but also of the variations, which is worth it, I think. Because, I mean, there's so many great ideas, which I'll get to in a second. So the sponge cake, you beat 4 egg yolks, add 1 cup of sugar. This is a sweet cake, guys. Beat till light. Add 1/4 cup cold water, 1 teaspoon vanilla. Then you mix together 1 cup of sifted cake flour and 1 teaspoon baking powder. I did not use cake flour. I never do when it says to because why? I don't know. I can't be bothered to go buy that specifically. So I just used regular all-purpose flour. But I did sift it. Then you fold the flour mixture in with the wet mixture. Then you fold in the 4 egg whites that have been beaten stiff but not dry. Because remember, you just added in the egg yolks before. Then use a wire whip for the folding is what they say. Cutting down and through the mixture gently until there are no more bubbles of egg white. Yeah, this didn't work for me. I don't know what kind of whisk they were using. It has to be like a really open whisk with only like a few wires. Yeah, I just used a spatula. It was fine. Then you bake in an ungreased springform pan or loaf pan at 350 degrees. Oh, wow. They give a temperature here for 30 to 40 minutes until the top of the cake springs back from a light touch of the finger. Then you invert on a cake rack and let cool thoroughly before removing from the pan. This is very important for a sponge cake because the fact you do not grease it. Do not do that. And don't flour it. Don't do anything to it. Just put the cake batter in. As wrong as that sounds, that's what you have to do with sponge cake. so that it can grip the sides of the pan as it rises. And that's what kind of gives it its springy foam texture. And then if you want to make cupcakes or you make a jelly roll, you use different amount of eggs and you bake it at a different temperature. So that's the variation. That's some of the variations. You can make them as cupcakes or as a jelly roll. Some of the variations that really stood out to me are you splitting it into two layers. You fill it with crushed berries and top it with cream and whole berries. Oh, sounds so good. I actually ended up doing this. I didn't split it into two layers, but I did dig out my frozen mixed berries, you know, thawed them out, and then topped it with whipped cream. Oh, it was so good. And then the other variation that stood out to me was to bake in a loaf pan, slice for ice cream sandwiches, in quotes. Scoop out the center and fill with ice cream. Serve with chocolate or butterscotch sauce or sliced peaches or berries or canned apricots. Oh my goodness. That just sounds so delicious. There's so many variations, guys. So I will have a picture of this on there. So here's where it went wrong. You're probably waiting for that. I was in my office working on the old podcast episode. The cake was in the oven. I did not hear the timer go off. And I have a timer that, because I'm like this, it tells me how long I've ignored it or have not heard it. And so I started smelling the cake and I was like, oh my gosh, I go downstairs. It's been in there for an extra 29 minutes. So it was extra, extra golden when I pulled it out. I think the inside of the cake was still springy and soft. The outside was very caramelized. So don't recommend that. Definitely take it out after it's appointed 30 to 40 minutes. So delicious cake. I also would like to try this one again. And this time pay more attention. Not have my door closed so I can hear my timer. Great recipes. I recommend you trying these. And why did I pick the most unhealthy recipes in this health conscious cookbook? I don't know. But there you go. The recipes will be in my Substack post for you to try and enjoy. Today's story highlight comes from the Santa Cruz Sentinel from California newspaper article dated the 15th of August, 1942. And its headline is, Indigents of Men's Ward Keep Fresh Vegetables Flowing into Santa Cruz County Hospital Kitchen. Now, I actually was not familiar with the term indigent, so I looked it up. Dictionary.com defines it as lacking food, clothing, and other necessities of life because of poverty. So, this article says, 1,000 quarts of string beans, hundreds of quarts of canned tomatoes, corn, squash, rhubarb, applesauce, beets, onions, etc. will fill the kitchen cupboard at the county hospital this winter, all taken from the hospital's 2.5-acre farm at the hospital grounds, County Health Officer Dr. John Fuller stated. For the past 5 years, aged indigents of the men's ward at the hospital have been puttering about with a small vegetable garden that has grown into a big supply center for the hospital kitchen. Started 5 years ago, 4 of the indigents at the hospital ward started working in the hospital farm 5 years ago when it was first started. In 4 years, the size of the farm has increased until it now supplies the hospital kitchen with a big percentage of its canned fruits and vegetables. This year, the indigents were aided by 3 WPA helpers in cultivating the farm under the direction of the hospital maintenance engineer. And from the farm this summer, the hospital kitchen staff expects to can 1,000 quarts of string beans. No telling how many quarts of tomatoes, as there are more than 2,000 tomato plants beginning to bear at the farm. Other vegetables will include corn, squash, rhubarb, beets, onions, apples, tomatoes, celery, radishes, and some lettuce produced at the farm this summer. Besides canning the farm products, the hospital kitchen staff also cans numerous quarts of produce bought at the market in season to ease the cost of feeding the patients, staff, etc. By buying fresh vegetables, then canning them, the hospital saves a great deal of boarding expense. The canned bean and tomato supply will last the entire year. Already, plans have been started to provide the farm with an irrigation system so that potatoes may be grown next year, with the farm cultivation enlarging to include the entire 5 acres of the hospital farm land, Dr. Fuller said. Not only does the hospital farm save the county lots of money each year, but it gives some of the indigents something to do and provides the hospital patients and wards with fresh vegetables and fruits the entire year long to make the lunches and dinners taste a whole lot better. I really liked this article for a few reasons. One is I like that, I mean, it details, you know, all the things this particular farm in California was growing, but also the really hard work of the kitchen staff in canning all of it. But I really like that they acknowledge these men who were the poor patients of the men's ward, who were, you know, what they called puttering about with a small vegetable garden, but how their work had grown to the point of being a big supply center for the hospital kitchen. So it started 5 years ago. This is 1942. So this is, their work had started before the war, and now it's really paying off. Now, while they did, it seemed like they did still have to buy some at the market because their farm is pretty small, with the hard work of the hospital kitchen staff canning so much produce, they were able to save the hospital and the county a lot of money. This is another example where it's giving these men something to do, something that seems rewarding and no doubt was good for their mental health. And then, you know, the payoff also is that the produce is being enjoyed by everyone who eats at the hospital. So just a all around great story. And I just wanted to share that with you. I have to give a big thank you to Kirsten and Brianne for helping me with my research for the U.S. Sanitary Commission. I also wanted to give a huge thank you to the researchers at the National Archives via the History Hub and the National Agricultural Library. Even though the research there didn't, you know, bear much fruit, I mean, I was so appreciative of their hard work in researching for me and also how quickly they got back to me. So I just had to say a big thank you because those archivists are awesome. I just wanted to also say thank you for following along with my podcast and for listening. It's hard to believe I am this far. So what is it? 31 episodes. This is so fantastic. We are approaching the end of season 4, but not yet. We have a few more episodes left to go. Thanks so much to my patrons, especially to Amy, for their long-lasting support. Without you, I couldn't do what I do. If you'd like to follow me, I am usually on Instagram and posting about all kinds of things, especially the progress of my research, little tidbits I find, and the recipes I try. If you'd like to be updated about my podcast episodes, they're, like I said, on Substack. You can visit me at victorykitchenpodcast.substack.com. Thank you so much for joining me, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.